Hi there again, I'm Jack Hopke. It's All Things New Orleans. Are you ready for Music, Moss, and Man, and Man's Best Friend? Well, all right then. In the 1990s, singer-songwriter Ani DiFranco enjoyed huge success on her own independent label, which happened to be called, as I recall correctly, Righteous Babe. Now, these days, she still tours and records, but she hasn't garnered the same level of attention. NPR's music critic Robert Christgau thinks it's time for that to change.
For an Ani DiFranco fan, amazed by her one fine album a year just like that between 1995 and 1999, the many albums she put out in the aughts just weren't up to par. So her new one, Which Side Are You On?, comes as a surprise and a tremendous relief. The first words out of her mouth are the most striking she's uttered on record in over a decade.
Every time I open my mouth, I take off my clothes, and I'm raw and frostbitten from being exposed. I got red scabby hands and purple scabby feet, and you can smell me coming from halfway down the street. Oh.
That one's called Lifeboat, sung in the voice of a homeless woman who's pretty jaunty, considering. Clearly, DiFranco wanted to get our attention and knew how. The rest of the new album's more personal. But one way it's more personal is set up by that homeless woman. It's consistently political and so feminist, it risks using the term.
Feminism ain't about women. Now that's not who it is for. It's about shifting consciousness that we're bringing into war. So listen up, you fathers. Listen up, you sons. And tell me which side are you on now? Which side are you?
That's the title track of Which Side Are You On?, a rewritten version of the folk chestnut accompanied by Pete Seeger on banjo and some horn players from New Orleans, DiFranco's current hometown. The singing is direct in a way it's seldom been recently because, as her political outspokenness signifies, she feels grounded again. Often, Which Side Are You On? Could pass for a love album to her husband and producer Mike Napolitano. Here's how a slow one called Hearse begins.
I don't want to strive for nothing anymore. I just want to lie here with you. Keep the walls outside the door.
DiFranco began the aughts in a marriage that ended in 2003. She ruminated and worked on her guitar playing. She won an album packaging Grammy. In 2007, she gave birth to a daughter, and in 2009, she married Napolitano. It would be too simple to claim that domestic stability got her back on the right track. Maybe it's just that, as one new song puts it, you get happier as you get older if you do things right. In any case, I'm happy for Ani DiFranco, who's never deserved anything less.
You know, I have enjoyed my life. It's been exciting.
Ani DiFranco, she's a singer-songwriter who now lives in New Orleans, as Mr. Christgau informed us. And I'm Jack Hopke, bringing you the February 23rd edition of All Things New Orleans. Let's talk about the latest edition of Louisiana Cultural Vistas. It features a wide range of stories focused on people, places, and customs of our Pelican State. WWNO's Paul Mawson spoke with a group of panelists recently, including Michael Sartiski, David Johnson, and filmmaker Kevin McCaffrey about the latest issue of the magazine.
Well, the name McElhaney is synonymous with Tabasco. We'll bring Kevin McCaffrey in on this one. Your piece on a spicy story, The Tale of Tabasco. Tell us about what you found out.
There are many archives in the state, many of them public, some of them private. And the McElhaney Archive is one of those that's kind of a by appointment only archive But when you go there, there are just thousands and thousands and thousands of records that the family has kept since the very beginning. Edmund McElhenney was trained as an accountant and was a banker in Louisiana in the early days and kept many of his records and objects and all kinds of things. The family just kept them over the decades and decades. And as of the 90s, it's begun to be organized into a wonderful living archive of both Tabasco, but also of a family that was a kind of classic example of a Gilded Age family that did a lot of benevolent work. They were Arctic explorers. They were friends of presidents and just all over the world.
Now, Kevin, as you mentioned, Edmund McElhenney was a banker by trade, so he kept meticulous records. What did you learn from looking at those? What jumped out at you?
What an archive holds are stories, and they lead from one story to another. I found that what you find is the growth of the story of Tabasco, obviously, and some of the things the family got into. Edmund went up the coast, and oyster saloons were very, very important at the time. And so he would leave a bottle of Tabasco and say, try this, and if you like it, order it from us, and all that kind of thing. So the popularity of oyster saloons contributed to the popularity of Tabasco, and it really caught on up the East Coast and in New York and all that kind of thing. So you kind of see that in the records. The other thing I referred to was the family being a kind of Gilded Age family of very benevolent and interesting people. As I said, they were Arctic explorers late in the 19th century. There's a walrus tusk in the archive. There's a Rough Rider's uniform, because one of them was at San Juan Hill with Teddy Roosevelt and was friends. So you begin to see all these stories, and then you also have all the objects that people have sent in. Guitars and surfboards and just people who do the Tabasco brand and all this kind of thing. It's hard for them to keep up.
I do want to interject that Kevin, in addition to being the archive editor for the magazine, this year is receiving the highest award the Louisiana Endowment gives for documentary film production for his film on Cajun foodways. And again, this is just a measure of the intersection of the remarkable community of creative people with whom we work at the Endowment. Kevin has been a bookseller, has moved into documentary film production for many, many years, and you know, we're just delighted that this year he was able to receive our highest honor in that regard.
We're looking at some of the stories in the winter edition of Louisiana Cultural Vistas with Kevin McCaffrey, Michael Sartiski, and David Johnson. Put some Tabasco sauce on some food, and what do you need? You need something to drink. If you go to Shreveport, and it's 12 years before Prohibition, you might not be able to get one, right? This is an interesting piece of history.
Yes, we published a story by Gary Joyner, who's a historian in North Louisiana, about Shreveport and its early efforts to go dry. In the late 19th century and early 20th century, many of us are aware, there was a fervor sweeping the nation to rid our country of the evils of alcohol. So across the nation, women were finding it very difficult to raise their families with husbands who were spending their salaries on booze. And Shreveport was one of the early test case cities. In 1908, a referendum was put before the population of Caddo Parish to rid the city of alcohol. It passed, but shrouded under accusations of voter fraud and intimidation. It wound up being a battle between the rural citizens of the parish, who were very much in favor of ridding alcohol from the area, and the urban core of the city, which were very much opposed to it. That's where the larger saloon business was established. And it should also be noticed that at the time, in 1908, Shreveport was poised to become one of the major brewing centers in all of the United States. There were multiple beer breweries in the city, and even Adolphus Busch of the Anheuser-Busch family had a beer factory in the city. So that also, obviously, just the jobs alone led many citizens to be against this proposal. But again, it passed, and Caddo Parish went dry in 1908. 12 years later, the whole nation enacted prohibition with the 18th Amendment, and that ushered in, of course, a decade of open lawlessness, graft, violence, the Al Capone era. And it wasn't until 1933 that the nation came to its senses again and passed the 21st Amendment, and we can all say cheers to that.
We're taking a look at the winter edition of Louisiana Cultural Vistas. We'll wrap up with a story on Julie Kane. She's Louisiana's new poet laureate, a chance for people to meet Julie. Michael, what can you tell us about Julie?
Julie is the third peer-selected poet laureate of Louisiana. She is succeeding most immediately Daryl Bourque from Lafayette, and before Daryl, Brenda Marie Osby, the great Creole poet from New Orleans. Julie is a native of Boston, came to Louisiana 30 years ago, lived in New Orleans, just soaked up the culture, loved it. She eventually went on to secure a doctorate in literature from LSU and has been a professor for some years now up in Natchitoches, Louisiana. Unlike Daryl or Brenda, who lived specifically in one geography within the state for virtually all of their lives, Julie, this is another instance of someone who was originally an outsider, came to the state, was seduced by it, and has really been part of several communities within the state. She's a very interesting woman. She's a tall, very energetic redhead. She writes rather formally. In fact, she has some renown for writing in a very classical style called the villanelle. But she has a robust sense of humor, a great deal of modesty, and has, as did Daryl in particular before her, a great passion for sharing it. In fact, the endowment, Paul, we set aside $10,000 of just our own cash reserves in order to be able to assist communities in bringing Julie Kane into them. And there's already a half dozen readings scheduled around the state.
Michael Sartiski, David Johnson, and filmmaker Kevin McCaffrey speaking with Paul Mawson about the latest edition of Louisiana Cultural Vistas magazine. More at leh.org. And at WWNO.org, you'll find all our features of ATNO archived for listening anytime. I'm Jack Hopke. You may have noticed some exceptionally large canines in many and unusual places around the New Orleans area lately. They are not your average dog. They are off-leash, but they're not running wild. They are, in fact, statuary. Joining us now to reveal the mystery and to discuss other activities of the LASPCA is its executive director, Anna Zarrilla. Welcome once again to WWNO.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's always a delight, although it's been a while since you visited with us.
It has, but I listen regularly, so I'm right there with you even if I'm not here. There's always a lot going on, and our programs and services continue to grow. This year, we're really focusing on our youth programs, so our summer camps are up and running. We have elementary, middle, and high school camps. We have also launched a new program, which is allowing kids to celebrate their birthdays at the SPCA so they can share the celebration with a cat or a dog and, you know, really get some hands-on time at the shelter. And we've also started what we're calling Critter Cinema, so a new program that allows young people to come and have an evening with some movies, get to know some of the shelter animals, and give mom and dad an evening off. We continue to focus on spay-neuter. Last year, we were able to do over 8,000 spay-neuters. This year, we've raised our goal. We're shooting for 11,000 animals to be spay or neutered this year. And we've got a great grant program that specifically focuses on feral cats in Algiers, providing free spay or neuter for people that live in certain zip codes. And we have other discount programs as well as other ways to make sure that everyone who wants to have their animals spay or neutered, you know, has that service available to them. It's so important for us to really push on spay and neuter in order to get those numbers down in the community so that we can really work with the adoptable animals at the shelter.
Speaking of Algiers, how are things going at the facility there? Now, you've been there for a while.
We have. We've been there now for 5 years, and we are in the works, our plans to expand on the facility. We're hoping at some point later this year we'll be breaking ground on an extension that'll include additional classroom spaces for summer programs, obedience classes, those kinds of spaces, a new adoption wing, so state-of-the-art real-life rooms where you'll see cats and dogs in what looks like home settings, and then an expansion on our veterinary clinic. So we'll have a new and improved spay-neuter clinic, as well as an expanded wellness clinic providing vaccinations, microchipping, and just basic wellness services.
About a year or so ago, and then actually repeatedly, there were some issues over support from the city and what services you were going to be able to provide. Where do we stand with that?
So things have gone really well in the last year, working with the new Landrieu administration and the city council. We're in a multi-year agreement, and so far, you know, things on both sides seem to be going really well. We're able to provide animal control services for the whole city of New Orleans all 12 months of the year. And at the same time, through our nonprofit side, you know, we are raising money to do things like spay-neuter, like education. Those programs really do, you know, counterbalance the enforcement side of animal control. And so it's so important that we're able to do both sides really, really well.
I'm guessing, and this is probably a pretty safe guess, that the animal population hasn't shrunk a lot at your facility.
No, it certainly hasn't. We've seen each year an increase of about 1,000 animals from Katrina forward. And we're doing everything and anything we can to get animals back home. So really focusing on microchipping and ID tags for animals to get them, you know, reunited with their owners, as well as adoption programs and transport efforts to other parts of the country where there aren't available adoptable animals. And so we've really been focusing on the Northeast and some partners that we've been able to connect with there, where they're able to place the animals that we're not able to place locally.
Sounds to me, Anna, like you're a busy person.
We are. And there's so many projects and efforts and fundraisers that we do because it takes a tremendous amount of community support to make it all happen. Coming up in March, we've got our fashion show called Allegria that'll be happening on March 4th. You know, it's a great event that showcases local designers. We've got our Dog Day Afternoon that'll be happening on March 25th at City Park. And then we're very excited this year to launch an event that we're calling a Mega Adopt-a-thon, and that will be April 1st at the LASPCA. And we've got about 12 different groups from the region coming and bringing the most adoptable puppies, kittens, cats, and dogs, all for a one-day event to try to get as many animals placed as possible. So
that's a heck of a lot of stuff going on within the 6, 8, 7
That's
weeks.
What I'm saying. That's only one month of the year. You can just imagine 12 months of these kinds of activities keeps us incredibly busy.
And there is, as I understand, an ongoing program right now. Tell me about it. I'm not sure that I completely understand. I know that it's involved with art. Paws on Parade?
Yes.
Am I right on that?
You got that right. Paws on Parade is our Mardi Gras bead dog sculpture project. So along the veins of the Festival of Fins and the streetcar project, we've, you know, partnered with Haydell's Bakery and created these fantastic sculptures. They're about, you know, 3 feet tall, about 4 feet long. And they are modeled on the little Mardi Gras bead dogs that kids make while they wait for parade. And what's fantastic is that the local artist community has just embraced this project. We've got just some amazing artists that have come on board, transformed these from just white fiberglass structures into some amazing, beautiful pieces of art. So they're beautifying the community, which is great. But they're also starting a conversation about the animals in the community. You know, spreading the word, going online to Facebook or to our website and seeing all of the amazing adoptable animals and sharing that with your friends and family. So when they're thinking about adding one to their household, you know, they know that adoption is really their best option, you know, rather than going out and buying a dog or a cat when there's so many great ones looking for homes.
Now, just let's make this clear. These things are in people's faces when they go around town to raise awareness. Now, these are actual sculptures that are placed right around our region, right?
Exactly. They're just all over the city. And we've got a map on our website.
This is Anna Zarrilla, the executive director of the LASPCA, and as the big brother to one big dog and three cats, my personal thanks to you and those of our radio station for coming and visiting with us today.
Well, thank you so much.
to sponsor or eventually purchase one of those dog statues or to learn about any of the LASPAC's programs, visit the website la-spca.org. It's All Things New Orleans here on Thursday evening. Our glitter edition here post-Mardi Gras. So, New Orleans jeweler Thomas Mann, he fits in here. His latest works are life-sized mixed-media sculptures in an exhibit called Mann's Mind. Now in its final days at Lemieux Galleries, Diane Mack spoke with Mann as he prepared for a closing party that is scheduled for tomorrow.
You know, your name is synonymous with what you call techno-romantic jewelry. And your latest exhibit is not about jewelry, but it does seem as if that jewelry has come alive in large, life-size sculptures.
Well, thank you so much for noticing that, because indeed that is the case. Way back when, I was an art major in high school, and I learned jewelry making. And then in college, I learned set design and building models of sets. Well, there's this interesting kind of parallel between jewelry making and model making, because the jewelry making skills make you a really good model maker. So the show at Lemieux is a real good example of my ability to make that transition and scale between the models and the larger pieces because of that skill set that I have.
Now, you've coined this term techno-romantic. What exactly does that mean?
When I formulated this particular style of jewelry back in the late 70s and early 80s, I was using found objects and industrial shapes and materials and kind of ideas in jewelry work that really, to that point, had really not been seen in contemporary American jewelry. So I was basically inventing a new kind of vocabulary.
Now, in this exhibit, it's a mixed media exhibit, what are you exploring in Mann's Mind?
There's basically four bodies of work. They parallel each other, and they overlap each other to a certain extent, but there's really distinctive bodies of work there. So there's the Trajectory Heart Project, and then there's the Aeroplano. This is my long-time interest in airplanes and airplane design and shapes and everything like that. And then this other one called Delicate Balance, where I've been making sculptures that have this really delicate balancing point with stones and wheels. And then the constructivist ideology that I've been using for years. I used to make boxes that looked like Joseph Cornell boxes, but now I have my own idiosyncratic vocabulary when I make these kind of sculpture boxes that all have lighting and a theme and all that kind of stuff together. So I just wanted a chance to kind of like jump out of my normal jewelry context and make several bodies of work that had nothing to do with jewelry.
I see an environmental theme here.
Definitely. For instance, one of the pieces is called Earth Cycle, and it's about the balancing issues of human beings on the planet. There's one that's about the Deepwater Horizon rig. It's called Energy, and about our decisions about what kind of energy we're going to use relative to their negative or positive effects on us. But some of them are just pretty much whimsical, abstract kind of exercises in the portrayal of materials in an unusual way.
Are you hoping to raise and perhaps answer some questions?
Well, there's certainly some very controversial little items in the show that would prompt some consideration by the public. There's one piece called BP, Bird of Prey, which I found a really interesting kind of like juxtaposition. I found this big old wrench that's used to turn the big bolts on the oil rigs. So I turned that into a bird with a redfish in its jaws, and it's flying on a tripod down the sky, and it says, BP, Bird of Prey, would you like your fish oiled today? I'm basically asking the question, you know, how do we live our lives? How do we access energy? And we're so spoiled as Americans for the most part with all of these things. It's just like really need to inspect those concepts. And this is kind of unusual for a gallery in New Orleans to basically do a closing event and to have an artist walk through and an opportunity to interact with the artist like this. So hope to see you all there.
Jewelry artist and metal sculptor Thomas Mann, thanks for stopping by.
No, thanks so much for having me on.
That's Diane Mack, your morning edition host here on WWNO New Orleans. And that's it for All Things New Orleans for the 23rd. You can always revisit our audio features and much more at our new look website, WWNO.org. Thomas Walsh, as always, did a whole lot of work preparing this program, and I'm Jack Hopke.